Reel one. What were you doing when war broke out, please?
I was in the Scottish Amicable Life Assurance Society in Liverpool, Castlestreet, Liverpool, just as a young trainee.
Did you actually hear the broadcast of Chamberlain that we were at war with Germany?
Oh, yes, yes.
What was your reaction to that?
Well, I had, I lived with a brother at the time in Diggs in Liverpool, and he was an elder brother, and he and his friends had suggested that we join the Territorial Army, that they were quite sure war was impending. And so I, as the youngest member of my family, took my brother's lead and joined with him the 7th King's Territorial Battalion in Bootle, Liverpool, as a private TA soldier, and went to my first camp with them, I think probably in June, July of 1939.
Did you feel a sense of patriotism?
Yes, I think my brother and I and our friends felt that a war was inevitable, and to some extent we wanted to get in on the ground floor, and I think we quite liked the idea of being in a tank for what it was worth at that stage. And the 7th Battalion of the King, previously an infantry battalion, was being changed to a Royal Tank Regimental unit.
Were you in any of the early bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Oh, very much so. I was here in the King's Regiment, and actually I'd commissioned later on in 1941 when the big May Blitz was on in Liverpool, and we used to take our troops down from Formby, where we had a big regimental depot. In fact, there was a depot which included the King's chaps who were going to go abroad eventually and feed the active units. It included the South Lancs, I think, and East Lancs, and the King's Regiment. And we took chaps from our unit every night in the Blitz down to the centre of Liverpool, where we were used on firefighting duties and that sort of thing during the Blitz. It was a fairly horrific period of my army service, actually.
Whereabouts in Liverpool did most of the bombs fall?
Oh, on the docks, on the docks. Areas, particularly, and the centre of the city. And the centre of the city looked like something from the First World War when they'd finished with it. It was, I'm sure it was as bad as Coventry in many ways.
How did public morale stand up to it?
Well, it was said to get a bit dicey towards the end of about a week to 10 days. I haven't got the absolute facts, but I was down there at the time. And I regret to say that there were occasions when we had to fix bayonets, or have our troops fix bayonets, to prevent people entering bank vaults and that sort of thing, which were opened by the bombing. And towards the end, that sort of thing was beginning to happen, and it wasn't a very happy thing to, it's not a happy thing to remember.
Whereabouts were the banks?
Castle Street, down in the main centre of the city, which was a shambles. And there was water streaming everywhere, you know, water, all the water ducts had been blown up, water was streaming everywhere, the place was shambles, really. We got the feeling that the people wouldn't stand it a lot longer. Fortunately, the bombing itself switched off then. But every night, you know, around about 4 o'clock, we were out in Formby, which is near where we are now, and it was like an evacuation of a city. People were coming out with their blankets and pillows to sleep in the woods overnight to feel safe.
Did anybody get any of the money from the banks?
Oh, I don't know. We just knew that we had a duty to do at the time. I was a young second lieutenant in command of a small platoon who was stationed around the what we call go-downs in India, the dock areas, trying to make sure that if there was a fire, that we could try and help to put it out. And if there were casualties and so on, we would do what we could.
So you didn't apprehend anybody who was looting?
No, I think it was a very temporary, and there were probably very few people that got involved in this sort of thing. Most people were, of course, at that time of the war, extremely loyal and extremely British and first class attitude to the whole setup.
Did you ever come across anybody who expressed the opinion that they couldn't take the bombing?
Well, it wasn't they couldn't take it. Most of the people took it like angels, or like young gods. They were tremendous in Liverpool, actually. But obviously, things were wearing a bit thin, I think. The bombing was pretty intense. There were 500 planes every night. About 7 or 8 nights, I can't remember the detail. Similar to Coventry.
Do you think the Germans were aiming at what you might call legitimate targets or just random bombing?
It's such a close area, isn't it? If you're aiming at the docks, you're just as liable to hit the pierhead, I'm sure, or the business centre of Liverpool. And bombs are not that accurate by any manner of means. And the whole of Liverpool is just one complex of major insurance banking buildings and so on, which were very beautiful. And the perimeter, which were the factories and particularly the docks at that time. The docks are resurgent now, but they went through their bad patch, you know, towards the end of the war. And but during the war, they were a very important area so far as the battles of the Atlantic and so on are concerned. Very important area. So Germany was a very choice place to bomb, I would have thought.
Was there any personal antagonism towards the pilots who were carrying out the bombing?
I don't know anything of that at all. I wouldn't have thought so. We just accepted it as part of the war. I mean, the war had been going on quite a bit then. Coventry had happened, London was happening. I think Glasgow had happened. Liverpool, we thought, it's just, you know, this is something one has to get used to.
How did you come to get out to the Far East?
At that time, we were a group of young officers in the King's Regiment, in the depot, and I think after about 6 to 9 months, we got a bit bored with doing repetitive training, and we felt the war, the interest of the war had moved abroad, and I think we were able to volunteer at the time for service abroad. And I think the intention, there were about 12 young officers from the Formby area, or the Formby depot, who went with me. Not with me, we all went together as volunteers, and I think the object of the exercise was to get to Singapore. But fortunately, Singapore fell before we got there, and we landed, and we were initially in Lucknow in India. That was our first station in India. And we then started training with, I was seconded from the King's Duke of Wellington's Regiment, 2nd Duke of Wellington's Regiment, and I followed them throughout the war, or served with them throughout the war.
When was it that you were training in India?
Oh, we went out in one of the big convoys from here in Glasgow. There were 2 big convoys, I think 42. I'd been commissioned about 9 or 10 months there, I think. And we went out in one of the very big convoys to Bombay. Then, I think it was March, April 1942.
Did you see anything of those civil disturbances of the Congress Party in India called the Quit India Movement?
Very much so. We were stationed when what we call the Gandhi riots, so-called, when they were taking over stations and interrupting the railway line up towards the fronts in Imphal and Boro, Burma and so on. I was sent once with a platoon to occupy a station, which we used as a base from which we tried to ensure that the Gandhi chaps didn't wreck the railway line.
What did you have to do when you got there?
Well, we had to patrol, was number one, to try and make sure the railway line was intact and safe. And on one occasion I remember very particularly was when we were having, shall we call it a siesta. We had 2 railway carriages which we used as our sort of sleeping accommodation. And my 30 men and I were all pretty well stripped. It was terribly hot in the afternoon there. Forgotten back where it was. But we were stripped off and trying to have a snooze and a rest. And suddenly, one of the private soldiers came and said, "Sir, have you seen what's coming?" And from the village nearby, the station, there must have been 500 Gandhi supporters coming to the station. And we presumed that they were going to do something wrong, and very quickly I got the platoon out of the carriage, got dressed, and we formed rather like the old stories you hear of forming a square. We formed a sort of square at the entrance to the railway station with our platoon, probably about a square of 8 men, each part of the square, and fixed bayonets, and I went forward and tried to communicate with the apparent leader of this organisation. And it seemed that they were upset because the police who were still doing their proper duty, were taking two Gandhi supporters to somewhere else, where they were going to be detained at our pleasure, Her Majesty's pleasure, His Majesty's pleasure, for whatever they'd done wrong. And they wanted to make a display of their emotion and what they felt about this. And we felt, I felt it was my duty to make sure that we didn't cause harm to the station or to the railway line. And so we had this embarrassing situation where we were standing with fixed bayonets and ready to shoot if there was any nonsense or insurrection. And I tried to communicate, I did communicate with the chap who led it, and I don't remember what I said or what I did, but eventually we struck a bargain that they shouldn't come any further. It was now time for them to disperse and to let the police take the two men they'd arrested away. It was a successful operation, so far as we were concerned, one of the most frightening I've ever experienced. Because I was then only probably about 22, and it was my first sort of embarrassment where I was in charge of a small body of men whom I might have to ask to shoot fairly harmless looking civilians. They all looked very clean and very pleasant, they were making a lot of noise. And it was a potential aggressive act by them, and I was very glad that we didn't have to shoot.
Did they seem to be inflamed?
Not terribly, no. Was they wanted to make a demonstration.
Was this in the Lucknow area?
No, it wasn't. Honestly, it's terribly hard to remember all the bits and pieces, but it was main line leading, I can't time to think. I've no idea. I really have no idea.
In what they call the United Provinces.
Oh, yes, that's right. And I'm sure the line itself was the supply line towards towards Burma, obviously, for our troops that were, you know, beginning to take over that area.
Did any individual Indians ever say to you, why don't you go home?
I'm sure they were probably shouting that at the time, but they didn't discuss it with me, no.
Can you tell me how you came to be a Chindit?
Well, the Duke of Wellington's were taken over as into the Chindit organisation. The Chindit organisation for the second Chindit operation became from being about one battalion strength, went to about 50,000 men, I think, of all sorts. That was Indians, British troops, West African troops. And we were just told that we are now going to be trained as Chindits.
Did you know much about what Chindits were?
At the time, no. I think we got the feeling that this was a big adventure and rather a stylish sort of unit to be involved with. We knew about the first Chindit expedition, and we knew they'd had a very rigorous time, particularly as I was an ex-King's officer. I was aware of the fact that they had a very hard time. But the sense of adventure was there, and this was perhaps the incentive was the fact that one was just training all the day in jungle and skin sweaty and miserable and on, and the thought of being an active service at this age was quite exciting, and particularly with a unit which had a sort of nuance of commando style in it.
Were these second Duke of Wellington's West Riding Yorkshiremen?
Yeah, basically, but of course they were a mix. That's a basic unit, of course, depots in Halifax, and a lot of Yorkshire boys amongst them. But they were mainly call-up boys. There weren't a lot of actual regular officers amongst them. Most of the officers were chaps who either TA or become officers and appointed to the 2nd Battalion. 1st Battalion was the main regimental battalion.
Can you describe in detail the kind of training that you had as a Chindit?
Oh, yes, it was very, very tough indeed, and in fact, probably just as much become a casualty, I think, in the training as you might have done on actual commitment to the Japanese. The training was extremely hard. We were very proud to feel that we were capable of taking this sort of training. We were trained in columns. We had to attack jungle in every shape and form. We had to attempt to be self-subsisting and to almost survive on grass or anything you like. We knew we were put in training to the extremes of water deprivation and food deprivation. And we were really trained, I think, proudly in many ways. The troops took it in their stride, but we were trained to live in the jungle. Wingate had declared that we had to beat the Japs at what they seemed to be very good at, and that we could do it, and that the training was going to be very, very serious indeed. And we were stretched to the limit during the training. I thought it was enormously satisfying.
Where did you do it?
Again, we were talking about places. Ranchi was one that comes to mind very quickly. Ranchi was an area in India where we were very much in training there. I remember that very well.
Was it jungly terrain?
Oh, yes, very much so. Jungly and hill, water, you name it, everything.
Did Wingate himself come round?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed, Wingate was about, and we were impressed by his personality and his the sort of fame that went with him. We all felt he was a sort of slightly religious man with a sort of almost a manic attitude to his jungle warfare, but we liked it. We liked his enthusiasm.
What did he look like?
Oh, he looked rather... he used to wear his pith helmet, which was a really bit out of fashion in those days. People told us of him sitting in his bath and combing his beard, this sort of thing, and he had very, very strong visual contact with you. You felt he had some special message in with his eye-to-eye contact. And although he was relatively small, his personality just came over as a leader par excellence, and a leader that one would like to follow. And it spread amongst the troops very easily. There was, of course, a certain amount of love-hate relationship, because he put us to the task so strongly that sometimes you a swear word was a useful way of describing him as a complimentary one. But that was typical of the British troop anyway in his training. They quite liked to be stretched, really, and were quite proud and felt that they'd overcome all the obstacles he said they ought to overcome.
What kind of briefing did you get before going in?
You mean when we didn't all go in together. I went in on a special servicing as a sort of decoy group of troops, 50 men, 5 officers, and a chap called Major Blaine, who served with Wingate in the first operation. And I went, my first operation was that, really. And I went in with gliders. We went in with gliders piloted by Americans.
Can you tell me about Blaine and his decoy group?
Well, we had trained as this group. We were supposed... Blaine, I think, had been very much admired by Wingate in the first Chimbid operation with the 13th King's Battalion. And Blaine had obviously done extremely well, and I think was given an immediate award of the Distinguished Conduct Medal. And I think also he was made a major in the field. He certainly was a major when I first met him. And I think Wingate wanted him to be active again. Blaine, I think, was trained originally. He was a very tough Scot, but I think he was trained essentially as an engineer. And Blaine gave him the job of collecting up reconnaissance troops or platoons from the columns that formed the Wingate operation, and he collected about, I think we were probably about 5-6 columns that he collected together, and we were stationed, perhaps this was in Manchester, I can't remember, but we were stationed in a jungly area, and then Blaine collected together some engineers, mainly engineers, and muleteers, who would be the structure which we would take wherever Wingate wanted us to go, by glider or otherwise, to do whatever Wingate thought was a useful commitment to the overall Wingate operation. It was just a self-contained unit, really, Blaine unit. It was called Bladehead, Blaine Detachment was its name. And I think it was just a little thing that it was almost a compliment to Blaine after his original service with Wingate. It was a compliment to him, rather saying, look, I'll give you some jolly nice troops, good, keen, enthusiastic reconnaissance, fast movers, and you train them up. And then when I want you, I'll call upon them. And they called upon us.
But you were meant to conduct a decoy row?
Not necessarily a decoy row. No, when the first the big second operation started, and Calvert and his group and Ferguson went in, and Tain and so on, when they went into the operation by glider behind the Jap lines, we went further south. This particular unit they met was sent further south, and our job was to basically to interrupt the Michener rail line to the north of Burma, but basically I think to make the Japs aware that there were troops further south than the main operation, and that we were told to keep out of trouble in the main, but try and make the Japs also aware through village contact and so on that there were British troops in the area, there were troops, Wingate troops in the area, and that this would leave the Japs sort of pondering how many. This was the idea. And we weren't many, we were only 50, but we did what we could, and we did blow up the railway track, and we did blow up a pumping station adjacent to the railway track, and then we got out of it. But the whole thing was an operation of movement, and we felt that our movements were probably being followed to some extent by Burma Traitor Army people and so on.
What kind of equipment did you take into Burma?
Man-pack stuff, hand grenades, rifles, 2-2 rifles, engineering stuff to blow up the railway line, and that was really about all.
And the glider flight in?
Oh yes, we were five gliders. We went in as five gliders. Piloted, as I say, by him. There were a pilot and a co-pilot from Cochrane's Commandos, an American group, which also had Jackie Coogan as a member, I believe, although I never met him, but he was part of the Cochrane Commandos, the famous film star. And we just went in from Imphal. I think it was Imphal, Tidham, Imphal, very close together. And we went in, we weren't trained particularly, we were just put aboard, and our mules were put aboard. And we were sent off to land somewhere near the Irrawaddy River, and we were to be landed on some paddy fields where the buns had been supposed to be more or less eliminated, and the fields made flat for our reception by some Gurkha troops who'd got in ahead of us.
Were there any casualties on
the
landing?
The only casualty on landing really was Blaine himself, who was hurt in the groin. I think he suffered a fairly severe strain to his hip. It was a weird landing. It was a sort of moonlight night, and we hit the deck and went straight into the jungle. And fortunately, it wasn't too heavy, heavily treed, and the wings fell off, and the bodywork fell apart, and we more or less walked out of the body. All of my group intact, very pleased to have survived that. And then we got into the open area where other planes were about to land. I've never forgotten the glider that had the mules in it was doing a rather fancy looping-the-loop maneuver as it came in. But it landed very well, and the mules just came out and started to graze. It was all a very homely operation. Quite extraordinary, really, to see all this in the moonlight.
How did the mules behave on the expedition?
They were tremendous. All the mules, as you probably know, in the Chinook operation, had their larynx removed by vets so that they could bray, and so they didn't make any noise. But We had one that carried the wireless apparatus and so on, and I've forgotten what we called it. I think we called it Jenny or something, but it seemed to fall all down every mountain you came to, and always survive. It would always get wherever you wanted it to go. The muleteers were wonderful. We had a muleteer attached to each mule with us, and they were great guys, and they seemed able to do anything with these mules. They were personal friends. Very important to us, of course, in carrying wireless and that sort of thing.
Did any of the mules get eaten?
No, ours were ours survived. Fortunately, I don't know what happened to them eventually. I can tell you later, perhaps, that we handed them over, but ours were all right. No, we were very glad to have them.
So, once you'd assembled yourselves after the glider landing, what did you then do?
Well, this was, I think I mentioned before to you that this was an occasion when it suddenly was revealed to me that I was going to be the officer in command of this operation, having never been really seriously involved before in active service. I'd been trained plenty. I was a senior of 5 young lieutenants, and Blaine not being fit to carry out the operation himself, he was going back in light plane with the American pilots who were to be taken out. And he was again, and so very quickly I was made aware, before I tried to get some sleep that night, that I was in command of the whole operation. And Blaine gave me the detail of what my objectives were to be. And it was a little bit nerve-shattering.
What were his instructions?
Well, the instructions were where to go, that I was in command of the unit, that we were expected to conceal ourselves within reason, but it was likely that Permatrate and his spotters and the gossip might get around if there were troops in the area, but they didn't really expect us to get entangled seriously. But we wanted at least to make our presence known in that part of Burma, which was south of the main operation. And the main object was to get to the railway and to blow up the line. I mean, 50 men, a certain amount of ammunition, you only do make a certain amount of damage, but we were to make it clear that there was an operation taking place south of the main operation. And we were able to do this. But it meant it was quite a whale of a journey to get there, and we went through the dry belt, which was not a very pleasant experience. To be without water for about, or very little water, for 2 or 3 days, when all the jungle is sort of all the burning with the heat, and no water in sight. Very, very difficult. One of the times in my life when I thought I might kill one of my friends, I could hear his bottle, what water he had left, was lapping around his water bottle, which we all carried on, you know, on our equipment. And I think as we were marching, hopefully, towards an area where there should be a river or another, I felt quite seriously that it might be necessary for me to kill him and drink his water. It was a passing thought, but it's the sort of thing that happens when one is, I think, I'm medically qualified later, and it's the sort of thing that one learns even medicine that you can go hungry for an awful long time, but you can't go thirsty for too long. So.